I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 17th of August, and Mondays at 1 means all things political. Our guest this hour is from Iowa. Well, he's from all over the world, actually, but he will know everything about the Iowa State Fair, all the candidates who have been there, the caucuses. He's a political science professor, Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University. He's also known as Dr. Politics, and is the most well-known source regarding the Iowa caucuses. We'll be talking about the presidential race, of course. And by now, most of the candidates have been in Iowa speaking, campaigning, flying in by helicopter, eating a whole lot of food at the caucuses, at the state fair. And we have a lot to talk about, and it's amazing. I never thought in my wildest dreams we'd be spending a lot of all things political talking about Donald Trump, but indeed we will talk about Donald Trump, and our guest this hour says that revenge politics could be at play in his rapid rise in the polls. He arrived at the fair on Saturday in a helicopter and took some children and Mark Halperin and Martha Raddatz as well for a ride on that helicopter. Our guest has, was born in South America in Colombia and studied in Colombia, Switzerland, and France. He speaks four languages. We'll do this show in English, though. He has published seven books and many, many articles. He's done extensive research in Latin America, has written about women's roles and rural life in that region. And he is doing, this would be a great thing to do as the Iowa caucuses get closer. He is the instructor for a free online class, Iowa Presidential Caucuses, which I believe starts in September. It's four sessions, and it should be really interesting. So it's a way for you to really participate and understand the importance of these caucuses. So we'll learn about that during the course of this hour. He has a weekly one-hour talk show on WOI Radio, public radio, where he is known as Dr. Politics, and he lives on a farm in Nevada, Iowa. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Scott Walker has made remarks today about building a wall between the United States and Mexico. He, of course, has been dropping in the polls because of Donald Trump. It seems as though everybody's dropping in the polls because of Donald Trump, so we will talk about that. We'll look again at the Clinton emails, which may turn out to be a big story. She says that the voters are not very concerned about that. She doesn't think that they care about this issue very much. We'll talk about what some of those concerns may be and ask if you think it is a big deal. And we will look a little bit at the life of Julian Bond, who, it's interesting to think about him. He was just a real leader, kind of a quiet, well-spoken leader of the civil rights movement for many, many years. Georgia legislator for a while, critic of the Vietnam War. There was talk about his being on the 1968 ticket, and it would be interesting to just think about what if he had been the first African-American president many years ago in this country. He was a thoroughly decent and inspirational man. So here's our phone number for you to join our conversation this hour. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. Professor Stefan Schmidt, Dr. Politics, thank you very much for being with us, sir. Hi.
Oh, Kathleen, it's such an honor and such a pleasure to be on with you.
Thank you. We're going to have great, great fun. Did you spend time at the fair?
I just flew back from New Hampshire, where I also live in New Hampshire. And I've been there watching the politics and going to events and finally got in at 1 p.m. last night. So if I'm not at my best, it's because I haven't had much sleep.
Well, sometimes people are at their best when they don't have much sleep, and then you'll just get sleep later, right?
That is absolutely right. And after we hang up here, I'm jumping in my SUV and going down to the fair.
You are? Okay. Well, and yeah. I would imagine you're going to see a lot of politicians because they are certainly still there. Let's start with Donald Trump. As I said in the intro, I can't believe that, you know, Donald Trump is dominating all of this. Somebody wrote over the weekend that it's as though we're living in this weird age where it's all a reality television show, huh?
Well, it is, and you know, politics is a lot of theater anyway, and we tend to forget that. We tend to forget that All kinds of colorful personalities pop up in politics, and voters get very distracted and excited, and they look at the latest shiny thing, and Donald Trump is definitely a shiny thing.
You talk about his blowing in like a bad storm, and at least for the moment, blanketing the Republican campaign. What do you think? It's going to be just for the moment, or does there stand a chance that he's in this for the long haul?
Of course, there is a chance that he's in for the long haul. There's a chance that he may pick up poll numbers and keep rising. There's a chance that he may stagnate. There's a chance that the voters may get tired of the shiny thing and say, okay, what else is there? You know, I mean, that happens. It's happened before. We have to remember that if Donald Trump has 20%, which more or less he has in Iowa, that means that 80% of the Republicans don't think Donald Trump is the guy. I mean, that's, I think, the best perspective on this. And the problem is with 17 people running, Donald Trump has gotten the largest chunk of that poll because everybody else is sucking away small numbers, and that means it's tough for someone to become the solid front runner. Mm.
Is he forcing people with his very outrageous comments that certainly find their way to television, and we hear more about Donald Trump than anybody else? Is he forcing other people, like Mike Huckabee, like any of the other candidates, to make some pretty outrageous statements?
Not this year, no, because this year outrageous is sort of the theme of our politics. You know, all of the candidates have taken very strong positions, sometimes very controversial positions, on a lot of different issues already. It's just that Donald Trump has a larger megaphone, a bigger helicopter, and definitely an enormous jet plane with his name on it. And so, you know, more attention is paid to him. And on some issues, you know, he may have gone a little bit further. But to say that, you know, Donald Trump's statement about immigration, that he's going to build a wall, is outrageous, and that, you know, that's not the Republican position, is, of course, not correct. Other candidates have taken similar positions and on almost all the issues that he's talked about. He's been a little bit ruder with women than others, but on the other hand, as some policy wonks have pointed out, the Republican Party's position on abortion, many of the candidates take the position that abortion should be illegal even in the case of rape, incest, or the health of the mother, is actually, in a way, a stronger position, a more divisive position when it comes to women, at least, you know, women who are not totally pro-life. And so he just shouts it louder and with a sharper edge.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't this supposed to be the year that the Republicans were looking carefully at expanding their base, that they would have to become a little bit more moderate? They had hopes of reaching out to Hispanic voters with Donald Trump's rhetoric. I can't imagine. He says that Hispanics are going to vote for him. I'll have to see the proof in the pudding. I can't believe that's going to happen. Mm. That they were going to look at reaching out to more minorities and becoming a more moderate voice in the country, but that doesn't seem to have happened. Why?
Well, there are a couple of things that weren't supposed to happen. Number one, there weren't supposed to be so many debates or at least political events as there were the last time around, when the Republicans all went at each other's throats and the party just drew so much blood that by the time Mitt Romney got the nomination, a lot of bad things had happened. That strategy hasn't worked, because even if there aren't as many debates, there are certainly as many opportunities for the candidates to basically bash each other, take each other on. And there weren't supposed to be as many candidates as there were last time, because the party had said there are too many of them, you can't have a debate, you know, with 10 or 12. Well, that didn't work, because now there are 17. And so a lot of things went south, you know, on the planning. And Reince Priebus doesn't have control of the party. He may be the chair of the RNC, but he really can't tell people, you can't run, and these are the ones that are the most likely and viable. And so when you have this many people thinking they either can be president or want the glare of the Klieg lights, as we used to say, then it becomes chaos, and it's very difficult for voters and for the media to sort of figure out the direction of all of this. But of course, as we all know, Iowa will do its job. I promise you that. I've talked to several prominent Republicans who are former students of mine. I've been doing this job for 45 years. So there are a lot of them who are now prominent, you know, from the early years. And they all said, we will winnow the field. We will make sure that by caucus night there are no more than three Republicans running for president who have fairly strong numbers, and they will go on to New Hampshire and try to do well there, and then South Carolina and so on. So we are in that awkward moment when things haven't really started to, let's say, come together. But it will come together.
And how long does that take? Your caucuses are in January?
Yeah. And it can take until, well, this year, you know, it could be November or December. But already we are seeing some wobbling. I mean, and you know, and your listeners who are very well informed know, I don't have to tell them, that Rick Perry just quit paying his staff because he wants to kind of hoard his remaining money and try to, you know, be more frugal. But he's already blown through so much money that he can't pay his staff. And that, to me, is never, ever a very good thing. A very good position to be in at this point. And so there are others as well, I'm very certain, who are going to decide that this, you know, they've had enough. And then at that point, the field shrinks.
So you have written about Donald Trump as being a revenge candidate. Tell me more about that. What do you mean?
Oh, you know, I read this great column about revenge sex, you know, and they're on some TV shows, you know, Two and a Half Men, Charlie always talks about how revenge sex is the best and so on, which is you get into a big fight with someone and then you go out and you just have sex with whoever just as revenge, right? And that's a very well-known, common psychological and sociological phenomenon. Well, Donald Trump, in some respects, is where Republicans who are really angry at the rest of the field and at professional politicians are going for revenge politics. I think a lot of people are there on Trump's side and saying they like Trump and they think, you know, he's honest and he says what he believes and he's not going to have to take money from anyone, just as a way of sticking it to the remaining 16 Republicans and to, you know, the Speaker, Mr. Boehner, and the you know, the president of the Senate and other Republican elites, because these are people who are mad at professional politicians. And Donald Trump is the perfect anti-politician in many respects. And so, in a way, it's sort of revenge for all the failures of the rest of the field.
And yet he says things, you know, started this whole birther controversy, which was ridiculous, and his comments about Mexicans coming to this country and his comments about John McCain. Don't you wonder about why people are attracted to him when he makes such claims that are, you know, they're really mean and they're really not true?
Well, you have to remember that there are still lots of Americans who don't think that Barack Obama was born in the U.S. And so, I mean, let's not forget that Donald Trump isn't sort of, you know, the only one thinking this. And there are a lot of Americans who are very concerned about illegal immigration. They don't think we've done enough. They worry about their jobs being taken away, about crime, about, you know, communities having to expend a lot of resources for public education and health care and housing and so on for people who are here, even people who are here legally. And so there is an anti-immigration strain in American society. And frankly, with Barack Obama, you know, race plays into it as well. So those positions that Donald Trump takes may seem ridiculous or abhorrent to many Americans, but to others they resonate, and they seem like no one else is saying these things or saying them anymore, and people are cheering him on, you know, for you know, for continuing to talk about this. I mean, he still doesn't want to say that he now knows that Barack Obama was born in Hawaii, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's switch to Hillary Clinton for a moment. Now we're getting reports that they found classified information among Hillary Clinton's State Department emails in May. She says that she travels and nobody really cares about this issue. I read varying reports, Professor Schmidt, that this could either develop into a very big story or it's not going to be. Where are you on this issue?
Well, I think it's true that it could become a very big story because it seems reckless to essentially do government business, especially as a Secretary of State, in which you're dealing often with extremely sensitive material, with CIA operations, with military operations, with very, very delicate diplomatic scenarios, and to run email through a server that, while it might have been fairly secure, was in her house, and to boot, had a backup server, which most of us have that, so that things are not only on one server, but are then protected somewhere else, let's say in case there's a fire, you know, that many think was totally inadequate. I mean, at one point I saw some information about a very tiny company that really shouldn't have had a contract to do something as delicate as backing up Secretary of State Clinton's emails, just as a common sense or lack of common sense to most people. I think it seems odd that that should have been done. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, people don't trust the Clintons much. I mean, there is, you know, they love Bill Clinton and all this, but they really kind of don't trust them too much, and Hillary Clinton is suffering from that. And when you combine those two things, you know, emails, classified emails, and not trusting, you know, it raises all kinds of red flags, frankly.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have written when her campaign rolled out here, let me see the name of this, A Weird Road Trip to Iowa. You have a picture of what she's traveling in, and like a tank, you say, named Scooby-Doo and Secret Service Protection. She wants be seen as somebody who's talking to the people and listening to the people.
Right.
Is she too heavily protected? Is she talking to the people? Is she accessible?
No.
No.
You want more of an answer?
Well, please.
Sometimes I talk too much. Sometimes
no, you go
I don't
ahead.
Talk enough.
We have an hour. Go ahead.
Because the truth of the matter is, even at the state fair, she was overly protected, surrounded by Secret Service, surrounded by staff, wasn't there that long, has to be basically scooted away into an armored vehicle and taken away because she has, you know, Secret Service protection and so on. And when she came to Iowa, there was this plan to make her do the listening tour, and she drove across the U.S. and came to Iowa, never once talking to ordinary people along the way. I mean, they had pictures of her, you know, buying some fast food somewhere, never talked to the person waiting on her, which Bill Clinton would have, you know, known the entire family history of that person. Hillary Clinton just was there with her cell phone and her dark glasses, just buying some food. And all of those things, and when she got to Iowa, she had a small and very selected group of people to whom she was speaking or who were her people she was going to listen to. There was a lot of, I think, very bad press that this was really not a listening to, that this was all staged. And Tom Harkin, our former senator and long, long, long-standing senator, said at the state fair that this time she was really going to listen and do a lot better than she did last time, which I thought was a very backhanded compliment to her, and she was right there next to him. He was sending a message, and everybody said, nope, it's not working this time because she's not doing anything different. She is not approachable, and I think if she had no Secret Service protection, she wouldn't be very approachable. She just seems you know, very private and defensive, and you can't blame her given what she's been through, you know, with the whole, you know, Whitewater and the Clinton scandals and the White House and Monica Lewinsky and all that. You know, you'd be protective as well. But when you're running for president, it's it's a little standoffish.
Yeah. So you just returned from New Hampshire. Do you see signs that Bernie Sanders really is gaining large momentum in New Hampshire?
Yeah, there's no question about
really?
It. Really? I mean, I see signs that Bernie Sanders is gaining momentum in Iowa. And yes, Hillary Clinton is still, you know, the one to beat, and her poll numbers are 50% and stuff. But the level of engagement and enthusiasm that Bernie Sanders has generated, and in some cases generated it with new potential voters coming to those events rather than the, you know, the people who normally go, this is a big threat for Hillary Clinton. I'm not saying it's a repeat of 2008 when Barack Obama came. Hillary Clinton was supposed to win the nomination back then. Most people have forgotten that. And when Barack Obama won the Iowa caucuses and Hillary Clinton came in third in Iowa, not second, but third,
mm-hmm.
John Edwards was still in the game then, and he came in second. It was a massive shock. She won New Hampshire, yes. But then, as you know, Barack Obama pursued her, got the delegates, won, and basically ended her campaign. That scenario is, I think, something very frightening to the Clinton campaign, mm-hmm. because Bernie Sanders is on the hunt,
mm-hmm.
and his crowds are enormous. We know that. I mean, Hillary Clinton is not a great speaker in front of large groups of people. She's not as passionate as he is in some respects, which I think is why she hasn't done those big events. And
right.
And I think that's an interesting story to follow, how Bernie Sanders will continue. But he's got problems, you know, of his own. I mean,
right.
He's too liberal. He's too liberal for a lot of Democrats.
Right.
So, you know, yeah.
And where is John Edwards now? I haven't thought about him in a long time. What a fall from grace that one was.
John Edwards is living a very quiet life with, a divided family with a little, the little baby isn't that young anymore, I guess. From his videographer friend who basically ended his campaign for president. You know what? I have no idea where he is.
Yeah, okay.
he hasn't answered my email.
All right. I'll try sending him one. We can find out more about him. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Dr. Politics, Professor Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. He does have, I think this is really a cool thing, he's got this online course, and it's a free online course. He's the instructor for a class on Iowa presidential caucuses. We'll ask him how you find that. There will be four sessions, and I think they start September, so you can be a real expert on the caucuses, which we're watching now, and we're going to be watching them until January, and he believes we'll winnow it down on the Republican side to three, that Iowa has its job ahead of it to do just that. Who may those people be? All right, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. I guess we have to talk about Donald Trump because of where he is, and our guest says that he may not blow over. It is politically significant that we're all talking, blogging, tweeting, and blabbing about him on cable, and that he's going to do something to the whole presidential campaign. And what does it say? What does that say about us, really? Hillary Clinton, what do you make of, you know, these stories are bubbling up more and more that classified data was discovered on her emails. She says it's not a very big story. Is it a big story for you? Bernie Sanders, is he way too liberal to ever be elected president? Julian Bond, I'd like to spend some time talking with a professor about him because he had such an important life. So we'll be with you momentarily. We have one phone line open for you, and you can do email talk at WPR.org. We'd love to have you write messages on Facebook, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for all things political for Professor Stephen Schmidt from Iowa State University. Willem and Colfax, our first caller. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I thought it was interesting the comments that your guest made about Hillary Clinton and her inaccessibility to the people. I think the same thing could be said of Scott Walker. I live in an area where Scott Walker has visited our town in the Eau Claire area for probably 50 times, and he's never been accessible to the people, or, you know, it's always some sort of guarded or ticketed event. But that's not really the reason I called. But I called because of the immigration issue, and I think that the things that Donald Trump said are not only an embarrassment to himself, but to our nation. And, you know, this the kind of things that he's saying are going around the world. And the immigration issue is, when I was a young person, I lived in Michigan, and the people that in the town I lived in that worked for Heinz picking pickles were migrant workers, and the people that picked blueberries were migrant workers. And now the people in our state who milk our cows are migrant workers, and many of them might be undocumented. And the people who pick our food in California are mostly Mexicans or migrant workers. So who is going to, are the American people prepared to pay higher wages to people who milk cows and pick our food and pay increased prices for their food? And most of these people are working, you know, 7 days a week. It's hard work being a farm worker. It's hard work milking cows. And to imply that these people are over here taking advantage of our welfare system, I'm not saying nobody's doing that, but the vast majority are working hard for very little wages. And I think it's a real insult not only to Mexican people, but to our nation in general to be, you know, making these charges.
Thank you, Willem, for your call. Professor?
Yes.
How do you respond?
Well, of course. Immigrants have always been the backbone of this country. And I was in the airport in Chicago having a beer and eating a little dinner just before my late night flight back to Iowa. And there was a huge picture, actually several, of Chicago sort of in the 1920s or earlier. And all the people in the pictures who were on the street with their food carts and they're selling wares and cutting people's hair right on the street, those were all immigrants. So we have been a country of immigrants who have worked very hard, often been exploited, had low wages, built the industries of this nation, and it's no different now. We are a country with a very slow-growing domestic population, and so immigrants supplement that. They come, they often are really searching for both freedom and economic opportunities to make their lives better, and they do work very hard. And, you know, what Trump is saying, of course, is sort of beyond, you know, what is in anybody's mind reasonable, taking 11 million people and deporting them along with their families, their children. There is a movement in this country to prohibit citizenship to children born in this country to parents who are here illegal. We've had that discussion before. The United States is a country where in most of its history, if you were born on American soil, you were entitled to American citizenship. And so that discussion is not new. It's happened before. It's happening again. We will continue to have that discussion. But I was told actually a couple of days ago by someone who knows more about this than I do that businesses, farmers, industries, contractors, and others are not about to support a really harsh and unforgiving policy that would prohibit worker permits and so on. And the tech industry, in fact, is totally opposed to harsh immigration policies because all of those depend on immigrants for their prosperity and for their growth. So I think what you're going to see is an alignment of different groups and different people on either side or on the many different sides of the immigration debate. And it happens to be this year it's flared up. It's bigger than it normally is. We'll get through that as well, and then we'll move on in the next election to some other hot issue, I think.
I think what's disheartening in this whole issue, too, is that there's a great deal of meanness, complete lack of hospitality on this issue, because a huge number of the people who are coming here are coming here to find work, you know, to give back to their families who live back in Mexico or whatever other country it may be. And for heaven's sake, they're risking death to get here. Some of them are dying on the borders. There's just a lack of of human kindness in dealing with this issue. It's like there are others.
There is. Yeah, no, and it's even Governor Huckabee at one time was compassionate about immigrants and about giving the children of immigrants an opportunity to get scholarships to go to universities and stuff. For some reason, he has veered off into a much harsher position as well. A lot of these people are actually fleeing tremendous violence.
Yes.
The number of people coming across the border who are from all the other Central American countries, you know, from Guatemala down to Nicaragua, is much greater than the number of Mexicans. So what we're really seeing is Central Americans. And this, you know, this is a country where people love to watch people yelling and screaming at each other and throwing things at each other on reality shows and so on. So we are, you know, we're fascinated with it, and we don't go to hockey games to actually see ballet on ice. We go there to see how much blood one team can draw on the other and how many broken noses there can be. And so why that wouldn't spill into politics, video games that are violent, television shows that are extremely violent, movies that are extremely violent, why we think we could do that and then not have it spill over into the public arena is beyond me, because, of course, there isn't a wall of separation between society and politics. You know, politics is part of the whole thing. So I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all that politics has become so brutal. On the other hand, I have a lecture that I do on nasty political campaigns, and C-SPAN actually came to Iowa State University and taped it. It's called The History of Political Campaigns, and they put it on their website, and they put it on C-SPAN.
Oh.
And I went through the horrible, nasty, much worse than anything we have seen here in the contemporary period, going, you know, all the way back to Grover Cleveland and others, where they actually, you know, called each other, you know, the sons of whores and things like that. So when we think that we've suddenly now become crude in politics, you ain't seen nothing until you go and Google it on C-SPAN. You know, Stephen Schmidt lecturing on the history of political campaigns, because they, you know, we actually would not tolerate what they were doing in those days. They didn't have television. They didn't have the Internet. But, boy, they sure could do it with speeches and handing out little pamphlets and drawing nasty cartoons.
Right.
You know, people shouldn't think that politics is a polite sport. It's actually a blood sport.
Yeah. Thanks, Willem, for your call. Claire in Madison, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
Sure.
I would like to explore with the professor something he said a little earlier, and I agree totally with the last caller. But he said Bernie Sanders is much too liberal, and I think he's drawing these huge crowds because he has a message. I've seen the man speak in person twice, and his message is resonating with so many people. I honestly believe he has a chance to beat Hillary in the primary, and I'd like to have the professor comment
Claire,
on it, if he'd be so kind.
What's the message? What's the message that is resonating? The inequality message?
The inequality, which ironically ties into your second hour that you mentioned earlier.
Right.
Yes, people are sick of the big money, the establishment in the political parties, and Bernie has solutions. He brought up the college issue before Hillary did, for example, and now it's been all over the news for Hillary. That's been Bernie's message for years, at least 1 year that I know of, because I heard him speak of it.
Yeah, Professor Schmidt.
Always. Absolutely, I agree. Number one, Bernie Sanders has always been extremely progressive. You know, when he was mayor of Burlington in Vermont, when he was governor of Vermont as a senator, his whole history is a history of you know, of always being on the side of the little guy and the little woman and the work families and so on. And I totally agree that Bernie Sanders has a
very good chance of beating Hillary Clinton. He's already ahead in the polls in New Hampshire. When I got on my airplane in Manchester yesterday, he wasn't ahead in the polls. And I have been also to his events. I was at the first event he did in Iowa, which was here in Ames, Iowa, at the Story County Democrats. It was the largest turnout they've seen in years. The room was packed. You couldn't get any more people in it. Hmm. The crowds were enthusiastic. And his message of social justice, of decent wages and so on, is a message that if he can get it across to not just Democrats, but all kinds of people who are living on minimum wage and not making it, who don't have health care, who don't have any job security, I think he can build a base that draws all kinds of new people in there. Hmm. He's considered too liberal by the mainstream media, who say, well, you know, he's not going to get the vote of, you know, the general middle-of-the-road Democrats. And it's certainly true that, you know, that group is more committed to Hillary Clinton at this point. But Barack Obama did it to Hillary Clinton with also a much more passionate message, you know, that resonated. And I have no doubt that he can beat Hillary Clinton if she continues to campaign so poorly and he and waffle on all kinds of things and hide from the public and not do large events where she infuses passion into the crowd, which she hasn't done yet. He's quite a charismatic individual, and I saw some fool. A commentator who was a political correspondent of some sort for CNN saying incorrectly, because he's obviously never been to an event, that, oh, well, Bernie Sanders, he kind of represents the old people, white-haired people in Vermont and stuff.
Not true at all.
Bernie Sanders is the Ronald Reagan of progressives.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan was able to get young people extremely excited about him. You know, they respected him. They thought of him as kind of a wise person who knew a lot about the world. I think that's the way young people feel about Bernie Sanders, because the crowds that he has are everybody. There's everybody in there. Now, the one thing he's got to do, he's got to go much stronger after Hispanics, African Americans, and women voters, and really cultivate those constituencies, because unless he does that, you know, then there's a limit to how far he can go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he understands that. He is working on it. I know that when I met him and his campaign aides here when they were just, you know, still in diapers, we kind of talked a little bit about that. They asked me, well, you know, you've studied the caucuses for so long. What do you think Bernie has to do? And Bernie in Iowa has to go after the progressive Democrats and independents who can come and vote on caucus night, because Iowa is the same day registration. You know, if you're an independent in Iowa, you can go to a Democratic caucus and register right there as a Democrat and vote that night. That's a very powerful potential. That's true in New Hampshire as well, by the way. New Hampshire is actually open primary, so an independent doesn't have to register as a Democrat to go vote as a Democrat in the primary, or on the other hand, vote as a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So Sanders has a great opportunity, I think, to cultivate that.
Yeah. A supporter of Hillary writes, Wendy writes this on Facebook, I really have trouble with all of this. Hillary can't talk to large groups. I heard her speak last year at a national church convention in Kentucky, and she was passionate about women's rights around the world and her passion for Charter for Racial Justice. She got a standing ovation from most of the audience there. Perhaps now that she's officially running, she's overly concerned about the right misconstruing and frankly lying about what she says to try to use her words against her.
Oh, I kind of agree that what she's doing is hedging. She is not, from the very beginning when she came on that little weird trip, I talk to Democrats. I know a lot of Democrats. I know a lot of Republicans. 45 years doing this, I know everybody. I'm like Donald Trump. You know what I mean? I'm not as rich as Don, but I know everybody. And the Democrats said to me, we want to hear from Hillary Clinton. We want to see her. We want her to come. We don't want her going over there to some little towns and in a bakery and meeting with a bunch of people she has handpicked. She made a mistake thinking that a listening tour could not also involve large and passionate crowds of people who were hungry for a Democratic candidate while the Republicans were sucking all the oxygen. I'm sure she can give a great speech, not as charismatic as Bill Clinton, but I'm sure she can give a great speech. My point is she hasn't done it. She has avoided it. When she came to the state fair, she walked around, looked around, ate a, you know, pork chop on a stick, looked at the butter cow. And then, unfortunately, at that very moment, everybody looked up in the sky, and it was like Superman, right? There was the helicopter with Trump written on it, flying around right over her head. She should have coupled that trip to the state fair. Instead of going back east, she immediately flew away back east. She should have stayed, hired a large hall, and invited Democrats to come and held a stem-winding rally for the large crowd of people that they could all connect with her. Because I saw many women interviewed who went to the state fair, who wanted to meet her. They couldn't get anywhere near her. They couldn't even hear her because they were kept so far back.
Right.
So she needs to begin to raise the blood pressure of Democrats in order to, to get them to buy into her campaign. And I think she can do that, of course, in the same way that I think that Bernie Sanders can beat her, or at least if he comes in second close to Hillary Clinton, then goes to New Hampshire and wins in New Hampshire, that's pretty good.
That's a big thing, yeah. Professor Stefan Schmidt is our guest. He is a professor of political science at Iowa State University. He knows everybody, Democrats and Republicans in the state of Iowa. He's written a lot of books about political science, and he is doing this online. So you, too, can become an expert on the Iowa caucuses. He's doing a free online class on the Iowa presidential caucuses. We'll give you the address for that as we proceed, and we'll take more phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls, 800-486-8655. But Professor Schmidt, as long as I've mentioned this presidential caucuses online course, we probably have some interest in people following this. How do you do that?
Oh, just go on the internet. I would say Google Iowa Caucuses MOOC, M-O-O-C. That stands for Massive Open Online Course. So Iowa Caucuses MOOC, and you'll hit it right away. All you have to do is put in your name and email address. We won't hassle you. You'll be in the course.
Great.
Start September 1, then it repeats. And it's a fun course. You can jump in and out. There is no time commitment. You don't have to start it and finish it. You can go in and graze or snack or whatever. We have some digital interviews that I've done with Democratic activists, with wonderful interview with some real old-time hardcore Democrats who were here when the Iowa caucuses were founded here in Ames, Iowa. And, you know, some interviews with Governor Branstad and others who sort of really tell you about the caucuses. And then we've got a discussion forum, which I think will be absolutely brilliant, because the reason is I already have a whole bunch of very well-known, recognized journalists who have already signed up for it. And they'll be in there discussing and sharing with you, and you share with them.
Excellent.
So very interactive. Iowa caucuses, M-O-O-C, and you'll hit it right away on Google.
Yeah, such a nice offering. Thank you for doing that. Jerry is next in Stockbridge. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would like to just make a commentary briefly. I mean, after the evasiveness that Trump has displayed, you know, all along. Now with the Meet the Press interview this weekend, where he sort of came closer to specifics, it becomes really blaringly apparent that he's almost in some kind of fantasy. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. He's going to remake the entire country. We're going to be great again. He completely ignores constitutional process, even popular will or, you know, party, their goals. And it's like listening, the more you listen to him, it's more like, at least in his his mind, whether he realized it or not. He's not trying to be elected as president of the Democratic Republic. He's actually outlining himself to be a dictator.
Professor Schmidt.
Sure. Demagogues come and they demagogues go. I don't know what Donald Trump's reason for running for president is. He sure is having a great time. He sure is doing what Donald Trump loves the best, which is you and I are talking about nothing else except Donald Trump. He may get tired of it. He may say, oh, boy, you know, this is just too much work. It's boring. I'm neglecting my businesses. He may be a stalking horse for the Clintons. There is, of course, that rumor that Bill Clinton called Trump and said, hey, get into this race and make some trouble, make some waves to upset the apple cart. I have no evidence of that. I'm not that well connected to know what Bill Clinton said to him. There are others who, you know, well, anyway, there's a lot of second-guessing as to why Donald Trump is in this. And I think that if he got the nomination of the Republican Party, he probably wouldn't get elected. And if he got elected, he might get impeached pretty quickly.
I want to spend a few moments on Julian Bond. I didn't know that he had been sick, and I had the pleasure to meet him many years ago when I was a Vista volunteer. Yes. He spoke to a group of teens I was working with. Do you think he should have been president?
Well, it was a little early. I knew Julian Bond as well because he came to Columbia University in New York, where I was a graduate student, and spoke, and it was the time of great turmoil, the Vietnam War. His life, it was amazing. He started out as a radical student, you know, one of the original leaders of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, then gradually moved sort of off into a more, let's call it establishment, change agent position, was a founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is still a very important organization. But, you know, the 1960s, race relations were truly abysmal, and I think it would have been, well, it was impossible for an African-American to get elected, even though, you know, there was a candidacy. He was also too young when he ran to actually meet the constitutional age for running for president, so that was, you know, an obstacle that he couldn't have overcome anyway.
He's worth knowing about, that's for sure. Jerry, thanks for your call. Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Well, to dovetail on Julian Bond, I think everybody remembers the Democratic Convention in 1968. And what a spark plug. Firebrand, he was at that convention. I think he even got nominated for vice president.
Yes, he did.
He was way too young to serve. But the thing is that he did. Part of the complexity about Julian Bond is that he became more establishmentarian as he grew older. And I think when you're looking for people to stay the course and to be true to some of the elemental aspects of what people on the left should stand for, you have to just keep in mind two basic issues, the peace issue and organized labor. And that's one of the things that got away from Julian Bond.
All right, we need to stop there. Thank you very much, Jim, for your call. Plus, the beeping was driving me crazy. And if you don't mind, we haven't talked about Scott Walker in Iowa, and we have about a minute left, less than that, and I wanted to get your thoughts on why.
Can do that. Scott Walker has declined in the polls because people are looking for shiny objects, and he's not a shiny object. So, you know, Dr. Ben Carson is now second in Iowa. Donald Trump is first. But there is a sense that Walker actually crosses the bridge between faith-based and social conservatives and economic conservatives better than any other candidate running. He's got controversial positions, but they match more or less the Republican Party.
my prediction is that he will recover and will come back up in the polls when people really start having to make decisions in the Republican Party, not Democrats, not independents, and that he could do very well.
Hmm. Well, I hope you'll join us again.
Look, it's always delightful.
Great.
You have a great show, and I'm a great follower of yours. Thank you.
Great, thanks. We'll invite you then to come back, and I guess he'll say yes. I mean, he'll say yes, right? Our thanks to Professor Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University, Dr. Politics. Don't forget that free online course, so you'll know everything about the Iowa caucuses. They're very important. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this show.